Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.
Welcome, everyone, to the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis, and glad you've got a little time to share with me today. So we've got pirates on the menu, and who doesn't like a good pirate story or two? I'm here today with Richard Zax, best-selling author of many books, including The Pirate Coast, History Laid Bare, Chasing the Last Laugh, and one of my favorite books of all time, Island of Vice, the story of Teddy Roosevelt's tenure as police commissioner in 1890s New York. However, that is not our topic today. Our episode today is about his fascinating book, Pirate Hunter, The True Story of Captain Kidd, one of the most infamous men in American history. Great to have you here. Thanks so much.
That's great. It's good.
So what inspired you to write a book about Captain William Kidd?
I think that the most compelling part of the story was that everyone gets it so wrong. I mean, at the time, they're starting to get it right. It's been 10 years, but they got it so wrong. And I was fascinated with kind of cleaning up the myth and getting to the true story. And I spent almost 4 years in the record. So it was the story kept changing and I think getting better. It almost plays out like a novel. You couldn't ask for better twists and turns.
Absolutely. So from early on, most of us develop this stereotype of pirates in our head. You write in your book that you had that same stereotype. Peg legs, parrots, eye patches, lots of R's. Where does this come from? And how do these stereotypes separate from historical fact?
Well, I think a lot of them, came from the early movies and the Captain Bloods and Errol Flynn and all the rest of it. And there are some historical facts in there. I mean, not all the pirate details are wrong. I mean, guys did get maimed. There were the occasional peg legs and eye patches. They did actually wear the clothes of a lot of the aristocrats that they stole from. So they were dressed pretty bizarrely sometimes. They certainly cursed more than your average person. I mean, some of the details are correct, but in Captain Kidd's case, it's just such a travesty. He was a privateer. He was one of the most respected citizens in New York City, and he was hired to chase pirates. So that's what really intrigued me about the story. And then he gets accused of being one, and there's a whole suspense drama. You know, maybe he did turn pirate. Maybe he didn't. I wanted to find out.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask you about that, too, just for listeners who may not be aware of the differences. What is a privateer and what is a pirate?
Sure, it's incredibly important to understand the difference. I mean, a privateer was a very respected profession back in that era in the late 1600s. Basically, they were nautical mercenaries who were hired by the king or queen to act as Royal Navy ships, in effect, to go and capture enemy ships And these were private ventures. So wealthy lords would back a given privateer who'd get a commission from the king. And whatever they captured of French merchant ships, say, or Spanish silver ships, a percentage would go to the king, a percentage would go to the backers, a percentage would go to the captain and the crews. Privateering was respected, and it supplemented the royal navies. On the other hand, pirates were just ragtag independent thieves who stole from ships of all nations. They were called enemies of mankind. And it's an incredibly important distinction, whether someone had a commission from the government or whether someone was a freelancer.
So what do we know about William Kidd's early life? How did he make his mark as a sea captain?
It's interesting. First off, everyone got his birth date wrong, which was really fun. I got a Scottish historian working with me, and we corrected that. I mean, it's not a big deal, but it's fun for a scholar. He had always been listed as 1645 in Greenock, Scotland, and it's actually 1654 in Dundee. So he was born in Scotland, which, you know, there's no United States of America at this point. So he's born in Scotland, part of the British Empire, and he winds up serving in the Caribbean on a Royal Navy ship. And he's loyal, and he's a loyal member, you know, of the British Empire. And at a point of war against the French, he gets commissioned as a privateer, and he names his ship. He steals a ship from the French. With a guy named Robert Culliford, they steal the ship, and he renames it the Blessed William. And I think it's a little bit to King William, but it's also to William Kidd. You know, he was an arrogant, tough guy. There's no doubt about it. He didn't, you know, he was not your friendly, cuddly man. And so he's Captain William Kidd, and he's a privateer fighting the French down in the 1690s in the Caribbean.
What did William Kidd look like?
That's a good question, because the Howard Pyle was the most famous illustrator probably of pirates. And he has a Captain Kidd that looks like some sort of swarthy villain with a kerchief, you know, bandana and, you know, the whole thing. I think he's smoking or drinking or doing both. And that's just not right. We have one authentic portrait of Kidd, and he looks a little like a nobleman of that era, you know. Long hair, sort of forceful, brow and stern eyes. And he would have looked to you like another, you know, maybe a minor aristocrat or a tough, you know, a sea captain who had put on airs, wanted to be an aristocrat, something like that.
He marries a woman named Sarah. Is that right?
Right. Absolutely. She was one of the wealthiest widows in New York City. So you can see how respectable Kidd was at the time. He is this dashing sea captain, and she's buried two husbands, and she's by all accounts attractive, and she's quite wealthy. They owned, in fact, the plots of land, if they'd stayed in the family, they owned something like 40 acres up around what would be the East 70s in the river in New York City. They owned property on Pearl Street. They owned actually a Wall Street building that Donald Trump either owns or manages for a while. So he married into a really wealthy family. He didn't really need to work anymore if he didn't want to, but he wanted to be a privateer. He even wanted to be a Royal Navy captain.
I know you mentioned this before, but again, he's considered an American pirate, but this is 100 years before America gets its independence.
Correct. I mean, we do call him an American pirate, and we think of Captain Kidd and Blackbeard are probably the two most notorious names out there in among American pirates. But, you know, it is before the United States, and it's the British Empire. And Kidd was down in the Caribbean, which had British islands, obviously, and then he's up in New York, which is one of the colonies.
Your story starts off with William Kidd being cajoled by a group of English lords to capture pirates in the Indian Ocean, and then split the loot. Could you talk more about this relationship and the bargain they strike?
Sure. It was a pretty unusual privateering arrangement. Part of it was totally standard boilerplate. He would be a privateer against the French in times of war. That was standard. You dime a dozen privateering contracts. But what was unusual here was he also got a privateering contract to capture pirate ships. And yes, the Indian Ocean was the specific area. And the reason was the English East India Company was losing some of its prowess, business, respect, because English pirates were capturing ships out there. And, you know, as maybe your listeners know, the English East India Company would eventually take over India and is arguably the most successful semi-private enterprise in the history of business. So this was, in theory, Kidd was going to go out there and capture, you know, British pirates and help the English East India Company. But there really was more of a deviousness behind it. Four of the lords who backed him had been squeezed out of the East India Company and were not making money there. So this was a way that they too could profit from the Indies.
And Kidd was able to negotiate the terms a little.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say they were great, actually. He tried to bargain, but on paper, he was supposed to give, I don't have all the numbers in front of me, but at least 50% was supposed to go back, you know, to the lords. And you know, these men that he was hiring, they were used to a bigger share. You know, this was not the greatest share. This was a pretty unusual. I think even 75% was going back to the lords. So he didn't really strike the greatest bargain. But, you know, I think he knew, like, I'm not saying he was the most, you know, squeaky clean man ever. I think he knew when you're out on the high seas, you could sell some of the treasure, some of the booty a little early and nobody would care. Privateering missions sometimes returned 100-1 on the investment, which is just unthinkable. I mean, if you get 10-1 as an investor, you're the happiest man around. 100-1 is extraordinary. So they were all going to make a lot of money if he captured a few ships.
How did Captain Kidd prepare for his voyage? How did he hire his crew and get things ready?
Well, that's really interesting, too. He got the ship built, a custom-built ship. That's how powerful and wealthy his backers were. Normally, you bought a merchant ship, you added a couple extra cannons to it, and off you went. Kidd was really thoughtful about this, and he wanted to have a galley, which was unusual. He wanted to have oars so that if another ship was becalmed and there was no wind, he could literally have his men row over, and that gave them an extra weapon. The trouble was that most of your average sailors didn't want to be galley slaves. They didn't want to be rowing, but, you know, it wasn't going to come up all the time. So he really thought about this ship. He put 30 guns on it. This was a powerful ship. He called it the Adventure. So Captain Kidd sailing on the Adventure galley. And he needed a crew. And that was always a problem in that era. There was a shortage of sailors. And the Royal Navy was notorious for its press gangs. It would literally get people drunk in bars, knock them over the head, and they'd wake up the next morning having signed something, and they were on a ship and couldn't get off. And if they, you know, showed any disrespect, they were flogged. So it was very tight labor market. So Kidd had a very limited crew that he sailed out of London with, and then he wanted to fill out his crew in New York. And like I said, he didn't have the greatest contract for the split. So it was going to be a little hard. So some people think he whispered to the men that he would take care of them, that he would do better. But Kidd comes into New York. That's a place, we don't think of New York this way, but the skyline was two windmills and a church steeple. I mean, it's a very, population 5,000, a very different, they had a whipping post where they whipped the slaves. Very, very different place. Kidd comes in there and he fills out his crew. And he actually knows that several of the men, at least a couple dozen, have been pirates before. But that's what the labor market was. He needed a crew. So he's hiring former pirates to go chase pirates.
At one point, while the ship is passing, I believe it's a British naval post or something, Captain Kidd refuses to salute.
Right.
To pay his respects.
Well, it's just that Kidd had a huge ego. He was an arrogant man, and he thought, here I am dealing with four of the most powerful lords in London, and I'm on a privateering mission. He doesn't get to fly the Union Jack. He flies what's called a privateering jack, which has a little red, and then it has the Union Jack. And it's, you know, it's to him, he is of equal rank to the Royal Navy captains. But, of course, the Royal Navy captains don't look at it that way. So before Kidd even leaves, he's already irritated the Royal Navy, which is not really a good thing to do when you're on a mission like that.
So what was the journey like for the crew of the Adventure Galley? What was life like on the ship? How does a ship like this operate so far from home?
Well, first he had to sail over with what I call a skeletal crew. You know, it's hard. I'm not taking anything away from it. But a lot of merchant ships had a crew of 10 or 15 men. I mean, once, you know, the sails were in place. The wind did a lot of it. I'm not saying it was an easy life at all. They worked incredibly hard. In fact, what I found interesting is they basically were allowed to drink a gallon of beer a day for as long as the initial beer lasted after they left port. You know, it was a tough life. You're climbing up, you know, the rat lines to get to the sails. You're dropping sails. I mean, accidents happen. I saw one study that claimed that this might be too extreme, but 3 out of 4 British Royal Sailors did not survive a 2-year cruise, either from accidents, scurvy, various other risks, you know, shipwreck, attack. It was an incredibly rough life, and these were rough men, and most of them couldn't write or uneducated, and would drink, you know, anything they'd get their hands on. And imagine he's one man on the ship, you know, a few officers around him, but it's not like he's got Royal Navy Marines or anything to protect him. And he has to control this crew. And part of the crew, like I said, is former pirates. I mean, it's an incredible premise. The former, you know, Captain Kidd going out with pirates to chase pirates. And then the split that he's supposed to give them when he comes back is not a typical generous split. I mean, it's a recipe for disaster.
Do I remember right? Do a number of the men die of cholera on the trip?
They got some disease that wasn't really identified. I don't know if they ever decided it was definitely cholera, but before they got too far out on the voyage, he lost 50 men to a disease on some obscure island called Mohelia, you know, so they were already needing crewmen. And then he gets this incredible bad break in a fog. He runs into a small squadron of Royal Navy ships, and he feasts with the Commodore, and all is well. But Kidd can clearly sense that Captain Warren, Commodore Warren, is going to want to take some of his crew, because that's what the Royal Navy always does. So Kidd sneaks off in a fog, and then Captain Warren starts spreading the reports that Kidd is a pirate. Why would you leave? You know, leave the Royal Navy squadron here. I mean, he just left it because of common sense. He thought his mission was as important as Warren's, and he didn't want to give up any crewmen, but he hasn't even really started. He hasn't reached the Indian Ocean yet, and he's really irritated the Royal Navy, and not a good thing.
So no good pirate story is complete without a nemesis. And for William Kidd, it was Robert Culliford. I know you've already talked a little bit about Robert Culliford, but could you talk more about his background and offer a few more details on how he and Kidd met?
Sure. The two of them were sailors sailing together. They were both young, I'd say, in their 30s in the Caribbean. And Kidd and Culliford, when war is declared between England and France, Kidd and Culliford sneak over and capture a French ship out of a harbor. And this is an incredible, you know, this is wonderful for the war effort. And they bring it to Antigua, and Kidd gets made captain. And we're not sure if this is his first captaincy, but it might be, or it's at least one of his early ones. And he's made captain, and Culliford is part of the crew. And the ship's called the Blessed William, and they're going to attack French ships. And the only problem is that Culliford wants to be a pirate. He doesn't want to be a privateer in the war effort. So Culliford and a bunch of other rogues go and steal the ship out from under Kidd. It's deeply embarrassing. He loses his own ship. And so Kidd survives. Kidd gets more commands. Kidd becomes a successful privateer. Kidd marries one of the wealthiest widows in New York. And now he's on this mission. And of all the pirates that he has to capture, one of the most notorious ones on the list is Robert Culliford. And Culliford's out there in the Indian Ocean acting as a pirate.
It sounds like the plot of a movie, you know?
Well, you're breaking my heart. It's been optioned so many times. And Nick Cassavetes, who's wonderful and who was in Entourage and made Alpha Dog and all that, he gave a very generous option for 2 years, but we just couldn't get the movie made, you know. So anyhow.
That's really too bad. So the Adventure Galley made its way to the Cape of Good Hope. What luck did Kidd have finding pirates on the wide open sea? And was he eager to engage?
I would say he was very eager to engage them, but he did not have much luck. He sailed, and they didn't run into any pirate ships. They didn't run into any French ships. The only thing he had taken so far was a little French fishing boat, basically, on his voyage from London to New York. And that actually was worth, I forget, 400 pounds or something like that, which was a lot of money back then. So that helped pay for some things. But he had absolutely no luck. So they went to the place where the ships came down and the Red, called the Red Sea, you know, where, you know, the trade coming basically from Persia down to India, which are these incredibly rich ships full of gold and jewels and silks. And Kidd wasn't supposed to capture those ships, but it was kind of a technicality. If a pirate captured a ship first, then Kidd could capture the pirate. And then the courts could decide, in theory, you know, who should get the goods back. Anyhow, that's where it was.
We will be back after a brief word from our sponsors.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mystery of Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
And we have returned. Talk a little more, if you would, about Kidd's relationship with his crew. It doesn't get any better as the journey progresses, does it?
No, it gets worse. And they saw, for instance, a Dutch ship. And the crew, with, you know, two dozen former pirates at least aboard, they want to attack the Dutch ship because, you know, and Kidd says, because we are poor, we should become rogues or something like that. He's trying to keep to his mission because he knows that they will eventually find a pirate ship and this will work out well for all of them. And the crew keeps getting more and more restless. And the leader of the sort of the gang that wants to pretty much mutiny is the gunner, William Moore. And he's, gunners were very important. I mean, it was complicated to load the powder and load the, you know, the rest of it and the touch hole and the cannonball and the whole rest of it and the carriage. And so he's the gunner. He's in charge of all of that. So he's a powerful guy on the ship. And he's sharpening a chisel sitting on deck. And he wants them to attack. And Kidd doesn't want to. And Kidd calls him a lousy, and we have this dialogue from the trial. Kidd says, you are a lousy dog. And Gunner Moore responds, you have made me one. And Kid takes a iron-hooped bucket. Basically, some people say it's leather, some people it's wood, with iron hoops on it. And he just swings it, and it catches more flush in the temple, and more dies the following day. And so the question is, was Captain Kidd preventing a mutiny? I mean, he could have had more flogged. He could have had more clapped in irons. He could have done almost anything to him. And was this an intentional murder? And this would later become very important, because when they're trying to put charges on the notorious pirate, Captain Kidd, one of them will be premeditated murder by Bucket.
That's one of the interesting aspects of the story you tell. There are conflicting reports of his personality. Some say he was just and fair, and others, especially the ones who'd parted ways with him on the voyage, for various reasons we'll get to, let me put it kindly, didn't consider him the kindest man in the world.
Yeah, he's certainly not the kindest man in the world. But I mean, if you think about it, sleeping alone in your captain's cabin with 100, you know, the voyage is basically called, the slang expression was no prey, no pay. These guys didn't get wages. When you're on a privateer ship, you got your percentage. And think about it. If you're a mercenary and you see like a rich, you know, shipment of gold going by, but it's gold that belongs to a country you're not fighting against, I mean, the mercenaries are going to really, especially in the middle of the ocean where you can sink the ship and sink the evidence, the mercenaries are going to want to attack. And Kidd has to keep order among all of them. So no, he's not the nicest guy, and he definitely has a sharp tongue. He's literate. He can write and read. And, you know, he was a tough captain, and you certainly had to be to keep control of a crew like that.
So fortunes changed for Kidd when he took the ship. And I don't want to massacre this word. It sounds like an Indian word. The Quidock merchant?
The Kida merchant is how the people usually pronounce it.
Kida, okay. So what were the circumstances of the ship's capture? What was the reward, and what were the consequences?
Well, the Kida merchant was a magnificent ship. I mean, it was a 400-ton ship carrying an extraordinary crew of valuable goods, basically Armenian merchants in charge. And it's coming back with just bales upon bales of expensive silk. It has gold and diamonds, might even have opium on board. It's this amazing ship. And Kidd does what we call a ruse de guerre. He flies a French flag that's, you know, it's accepted in times of war to trade. It's like when the police officer says, "Your partner confessed already. You better save your own skin," you know, and then the person tells the whole story, and then it turns out the partner didn't confess. So this is similar, flying a French flag. And the other ship, the Kida merchant, you know, pulls the French flag and flies it. And Kidd talks to the captain, and they exchange the documents. They call them passports. These were the documents under which a ship sailed. Like we talked today about a ship being registered in Liberia or the Bahamas or something. So this ship was sailing under a French passport, and Kidd says, "I have captured you." Kidd had sent over someone who could speak French, and once the guy had gotten the passport from him, he basically says, "I've captured you." And so technically, according to Kidd's privateering commission, this was a legal capture within the dates that he was allowed. And it was an incredible moment for them. They were all going to become rich, you know, taking this ship. Now, was this really a French ship? I mean, how do you define that? And was this a pirate ship? No. Kida Merchant was not a pirate ship.
But there are ultimately consequences for taking this ship. The British government views him far differently after this capture, right?
Right. It's terrible for him on some level, because some of the goods were going to some of the most powerful men in India, who the British, you know, East India Company was trying to make trade deals with. And so, you know, the Grand Mogul and the rest of it. And it was probably one of the worst ships he could have captured for that reason. So now the English East India Company desperately wants nothing to do with him, because they call him the English pirate. You know, the Grand Mogul is convinced this man's just an English pirate who's stolen. I mean, he doesn't care about the technicalities of that French pass that was being the you know, in fairness, the guy might have been carrying passes from France and Portugal and Spain and Britain, and he might have had four passes on, but he handed over the French pass. So, no, Kidd is So Kid basically has to hightail it back to basically a pirate outpost, and he claims that he wants to capture more pirate ships down there. It's the perfect place to go. It's a place called Ile Sainte Marie, or St. Mary's Island, off the coast of Madagascar.
I'd like to ask you about this. In April of 1698, Kid, in reaching Madagascar, finally encounters the pirate Robert Culliford and his ship, the Mocha. Can you talk about this encounter? What happens between them?
Well, Culliford has been successful. He's captured the Mocha frigate, which now he has a very powerful ship to use as his pirate ship. And he too has amassed some treasure for his pirate crew, but it is a pirate crew. There is no gray area about it. And Kid claims he sails into the harbor there, and Kid orders his crew, and he still has 100 men, orders his crew to attack the pirate ship. This is perfect. They already have the goods from two ships, the Kita Merchant and another one, the Rouparel, that they've captured, both with French passes, and now they're about to take a pirate ship. This is perfect. And Kid's crew mutinies over to Culliford. I mean, you can't make this up. I mean, Kid had the dialogue at the trial or something like he orders them to shoot, and one man on Kid's crew yells, "I'd rather put two balls into you." And another one shouts, 10 balls into you." They clearly, a lot of the crew hated Captain Kid, and they mutinied over to Culliford. And they took, a lot of the treasure, but Kid remarkably was able to keep a lot of the goods, and especially the gold and the silver, the smaller amounts of things, separate from the pirates who partied, on the Mocha frigate. And he lost 100 crewmen. We have the names to this day that mutinied over to Robert Culliford.
So how many men does that leave Kid with to return to America?
The Blessed William, the Adventure Galley is really not that seaworthy anymore. So they basically have to burn the Adventure Galley. He has 15 crewmen, including, I think, 5 of them are just cabin boys. I mean, this is a ridiculous situation. He has an incredibly valuable treasure. I mean, a fabulous treasure. And he has 15 men to protect it, and 5 are boys. And his ship's too leaky. The Adventure Galley's too leaky to sail. And he basically burns it for parts. And then he is going to sail back on the Kita Merchant. So he has a skeleton crew to sail back a 400-ton ship with the gold and the silver. He has something like 150 pounds of silver and 75 pounds of gold. And he's going to head back, and he thinks that he's pulled off a miracle, that he's going to deliver to his backers this extraordinary treasure and be hailed as a hero.
He eventually learns that people are lying in wait for him, though, including former members of his crew, the ones who left him for Culliford, I believe, and he's forced to make an extra long journey, right, to avoid the New York harbor.
He does, absolutely. He has a decision. He's a little worried if he just sails straight into New York. He doesn't know what his welcome will be. And so he, as a smart man, he hedges his bet. He sails to the Caribbean first, and he finds out he had to fear this. His worst, because he knew that he had irritated the Royal Navy and the English East India Company. He had to know there was a chance this could happen. When he hits Anguilla and sends a small boat ashore incognito, he discovers he's one of the most wanted men in the British Empire. So he has this treasure. He has this ship that he can barely sail because it's way too big for his crew. And he has a major problem. How can he figure out? There are no telephones back then. There's no telegraph. How can he find out if his backer in the Americas, Governor Bellamont, who's the governor of New York and Massachusetts at the time, how can he find out if Lord Bellamont will protect him and what he should do? So Kid has a problem.
And Bellamont ultimately betrays him. Can you talk about how he lured Kid back into his confidence?
It's interesting. Just before getting to that, what Kid decides to do. So he's down in the Caribbean, and he basically starts selling some of the treasure to finance his way to get to New York. So he sells a bit of treasure, and he buys a boat, the San Antonio, which would just look like a nondescript, relatively small boat, but he's not carrying that much. A number of bales, and the gold and the silver, fit into chests. And he has some jewels too, some diamonds and emeralds. And he gets this San Antonio. We have all the records of the merchants that he traded with down there who bought the pirate goods, who gave him more cash. And Kid sails with his tiny crew up to New York. And Kid, again, is cunning. He stays out on the Long Island area, doesn't come into New York Harbor, and he sends a boat ashore to get his lawyer. You know, he lawyers up, basically. He gets a guy named James Emmett, who is one of the founders, along with Kid, of Trinity Church in Manhattan. And Emmett meet him in a pretty out-of-the-way place in Stonington, Connecticut, so that they can discuss what the best strategy is. And Kid tells his story, and Emmett then goes and meets with Lord Bellamont. And Lord Bellamont is quite devious. He does everything to make Kid think that Kid is extraordinarily welcome. He does kind of word the letter, if you read it closely, "if your story proves to be as you say," or something like that. But basically, it's a very welcoming letter. And Kid decides he's not totally convinced that Lord Bellamont will be on his side. So Kid does another cunning thing. He hides the bulk of his treasure on Gardner's Island, which is up near the eastern tip of Long Island. And it's, you know, sparsely populated. And he makes a deal with Gardner, the owner. And so he hides the bulk of his treasure there. And he hides a little bit on Connecticut Island, which would become Jamestown, Rhode Island, with a Captain Thomas Paine. He hides some pounds of gold there. And then he sails up into Boston. And he thinks that this is his sort of get out of jail card, the fact that his treasure is hidden elsewhere. But it doesn't quite work out that way.
So Kid is arrested and sent to Stone Prison. What was Stone Prison like for him? Obviously not very pleasant.
No, it's cold, it's damp. Kid's wife, Sarah, beautiful widow, former widow Sarah, has come up to be with him. She's brought her family possessions, silver, and she's, you know, wealthy. She comes up there, and Kid is treated as a notorious pirate. You know, at first, he looks like he's going to be able to lead them to the treasure, and this might be his chance to escape. But then Lord Bellamont keeps probing through various nautical officials, people who are in Boston Harbor, people who've had contact with Kid, and he actually finds out about where the goods are stashed on Gardner's Island. So he's able to send someone to Gardner to get the treasure. So now Kid has absolutely no leverage, and now it's in Bellamont's best interest to turn over the treasure and turn over Kid to the other lords who are far more powerful than Lord Bellamont, the other lords back in London. And that's basically what Lord Bellamont wants to do. But then there's a problem that there are some members of the House of Commons who want to prove that Kid was a pirate, and they want to disgrace the lords and disgrace the king. And so he has to keep Kid in prison almost a whole year till House of Commons is back in session, because they want Kid to testify before. This is an enormous scandal. I mean, the King of England is being accused of hiring a pirate to steal from the East Indies. And the lords just cannot allow the story to go that way. They need the story to be, they hired a privateer and Kid turned pirate. They need to demonize Kid and hang Kid. That's their goal. So Kid's caught in the middle of a political tug of war.
So eventually Kid was transported to England to face an interrogation by Parliament. And unbeknownst to him, Tory politicians wanted to use him as a political tool. Is that right?
Right. They want to disgrace these four lords. I mean, this was the Lord of the Admiralty. These are really four of the most powerful men in England. It's extraordinary that they were the backers. They didn't even sign the document, though. They had like their shills. They had, you know, like the groom from the stable signed for one of them. But this was a chance to make 100-1. And I think in their heart of hearts, the lords hoped that pirate ship had just captured East India goods right from the British East. These were competitive men. And they were not allowed. East India Company was a very small club of wealthy lords. These lords had been excluded from it. And I think they would have liked nothing better than Kid to have captured a pirate ship full of East India goods, and they could have kept them. But so Kid is grilled, and he defends himself articulately. He says the two ships I captured were with French passes. You know, I've done nothing wrong. But it still doesn't work out well.
And in what is a complete surprise to him, Kid is suddenly on trial for piracy on the high seas and the murder of William Moore. Were his attorneys competent defenders?
No, they were not competent at all, and they were being paid quite a significant sum, and they somehow mysteriously disappeared right before his trial too, which makes it of course worse. And they were back then. They were supposedly only allowed to advise him in points of law. It's complicated, but they really did not help him with his defense. But the heart of his defense are these two French letters. These two letters of passage that each of the two main ships that Captain Kidd captured were carrying. So his defense completely hinges on that. And Kidd didn't even know that he was going to be charged with the murder. That was a complete surprise. But he's convinced that the letter French letters will exonerate him and he won't have a problem. But when they get to trial and he asks that these letters be produced, the judge actually tells him that the letters have been lost if they ever existed. And Kidd's just flabbergasted. I mean, those letters have been read in Parliament. Of course they existed. But to the 12 men in the jury, whatever the judge says is fact. And if they ever existed. I mean, that's the most arrogant line in Kidd's trial. So he did not get a fair trial.
What arguments did prosecutors use against Kidd? And what was the eventual outcome of the trial?
Well, the arguments were pretty straightforward. They got two of the people who mutinied against Kidd and turned pirate, a guy named Joseph Palmer and a doctor, Robert Bradenham. And it's interesting, Bradenham got captured by William Penn's men in Pennsylvania with a huge pirate treasure. And he was facing the noose. He was going to be hanged as a pirate. So he turns crown witness against Kidd. And Kidd is furious because these were two of the most notorious pirates against him who'd gone over to Culliford and taken pure, illegal booty, impure illegal booty. And they are the witnesses against him. And he was just accused them of, have you been promised your life, to sell out mine or to give away mine? I am the innocent of them all. I've been perjured by wicked people. He just can't, when he has to look at those two men testifying against him, it's just too much to bear. But they basically testified they don't know if those French passes existed, and they just completely sold him out.
Kidd really had no chance at all. He was doomed from the very start, right?
Pretty much. He seemed to have a chance if the French passes were produced, and he had no reason to believe, here are these periwig judges, mouthing polysyllables. Why aren't they going to at least follow some aspects of the law and deliver the documents? At one point, some young man, like a cabin boy, says, here's a letter that shows, Captain Kidd's honorableness. And the judge says something like, he knows we can't hear anything viva voce or something like that. That it's as though the judges are throwing every little trick. I mean, so the letter had to be read aloud. And the cabin boy couldn't know that. And the letter's never read into the court record. I mean, it just at every turn, the judges were completely biased against Kidd. And he was a Scot. Scottish and Irish were not thought well of in that time in the empire.
So William Kidd was sentenced to be executed on May 23rd, 1701. How was he killed?
He was hanged. He tried to save his life by offering to take a ship and deliver 100,000 pounds of treasure. And I think this is where the rumors of, Kidd's incredible treasure come from, is from that he sent that letter to Parliament and it was widely known that he was offering to go bring back a huge treasure. But they turned down his offer. They didn't believe there was a treasure. And so he's hanged and it's in Wapping and it's on this special dock that's in the Thames, because technically Court of the Admiralty did not have jurisdiction on land, on dry land. So they have a sort of low tide area that's actually under the Thames water during the day, or during most of the day. But then when the Thames goes down, there's the shore there. And it's so technically it's within the jurisdiction of the Admiralty. And executions back then were huge celebrations. I mean, there were people, sold snacks and pies and, rum, beer. It was just a big raucous party. They followed the prisoners. There were four prisoners that day. They followed them in the cart as they're being drawn to execution dock in Wapping. And, there'd be a minister there, and each of the prisoners was allowed to say his final words. And some of them, people say some of the most pathetic thing would be like, prisoner's final words, it would go on and on and on when he had nothing more to say, just to extend his life a little bit. And the picture of the execution is a little different than a lot of, you know, people who've seen Wild West, you know, hangings. They basically built a scaffold, and they had four ropes hanging down, but they had a platform and they just had some pillars underneath it, so that when the time came for the person to be hanged, they could just pull out the little props underneath and the floor would fall down, this whole floor. But back in that day, they didn't have a long drop. They didn't want to have like a 6-foot drop that would snap the man's neck and make it over. The drop was maybe a foot or so. And so the person would slowly strangle to death. And it was just horrible. And they'd pee on themselves. And people would be yelling out raucous things. There's an old expression, you'll pee when you can't whistle, you know, about being hanged or doing the sheriff's dance, because they kicked out their legs and their arms weren't tied in front of them, because a man in losing his life can roll his wrists and pull his hands out. They were trussed at the elbows behind them, so you couldn't free yourself. And the amazing thing is when they went to hang Kidd, the rope broke the first time. And there was a tradition in English justice about, you know, this is sort of a miracle from God and you'll be pardoned. But they didn't do that in Kidd's case. And then they had to redo the whole thing and, you know, climb up a little ladder and reattach a new noose. And then he was hanged. And his body was taken out to where the Thames flows in at Tilbury Point. And it was covered in tar and hung in chains as a warning to others not to pursue the life of piracy.
What were some of the difficulties you had in researching this book?
It was hard. I went to the Public Record Office in London and spent about a month with the original documents. And my breakthrough moment was when I found a prisoner's diary aboard Robert Culliford's ship. That was just the coolest moment because I knew Culliford and Kidd had crossed paths. I knew about them in the Caribbean, and I obviously knew about the mutiny, and I knew that Culliford was in Newgate Prison at the time that Kidd was eventually hanged, but I really couldn't flesh out Culliford's career. So he was going to be this stick figure of a villain or a, you know, of the person Kidd was chasing. And then I found William Willock's narrative of, I think it's 10 or 11 months aboard Culliford's ship. And then I was able to, now I knew the names of all the ships he had captured. I knew where he had sailed. I could describe the ports. Culliford became a real character. And, you know, I gave about a quarter or a third of the book over to Robert Culliford because that seemed like the right thing to do. And it was really, I love reading those. These are handwritten copies, you know, at the Public Record Office, the National Archives in England, and they treat you so well, and they hand you the original document from 1699, and it's just an amazing experience.
And the stuff you wrote about Culliford, it's such a historical gem, because nothing was really known about Culliford before your book.
Right. Literally, there was a paragraph in some ridiculous book called The Pirates Who's Who that got, I think, every single detail wrong about him. I mean, I found out he was from East Lewe in Cornwall, where they were notorious for pretending that the lighthouse was further ashore so that people would wreck their ships on the reefs. You know, if the lighthouse is at the edge, you know where you are. But if you move the lighthouse in, you think you still have safety. And he was from that area, East Lewe. And I just found out they were ridiculous. Sometimes they wanted to shred the sails of another ship and they threw the china, literally the cups and saucers that they had captured from some previous ship, they threw them in the cannons to see if that would shred the sails of another ship. They snuck up on a ship pre-dawn, and Culliford ordered the pirate band to strike up a tune and shock the other ship. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. These were authentic facts in this man's diary. It was wonderful.
That's great. Where can people go to learn more about you and your work?
Well, piratehunter.com still exists, richardzacks.com. The book is Pirate Hunter, and I'm really proud of it. Time picked it as one of the best nonfiction books of the year that it came out. And piratehunter.com. I've been doing some nonfiction since then, but pirates are pretty close to my heart, I got to admit.
Thanks so much. And is there any chance you might join me again this year to talk about Island of Ice?
Sure. That's another one I've come close to selling movie rights to. I'm the, you know, Mr. Close Call on this stuff. Yeah, absolutely. I love 1890s New York.
Thanks again.
Thanks.
And you can purchase Pirate Hunter, The True Story of Captain Kidd by Richard Zaks on Amazon, barnesandnoble.com, or any fine bookstore near you. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.
All you need is a few minutes to start your day off with something historic when you listen to the This Day in History podcast. Every day there's a new episode for you to listen and learn about what happened that day way back when. So listen and subscribe to This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts. That's This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.